Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager bringing you another hour of real information. That's a play on real politics that you won't hear in very many other places. First, to the Elie Wiesel Watch, I want to emphasize the gathering in Toronto, Canada on May 31st. When Wiesel and Salman Rushdie hold a forum after a fancy dinner at Beth Tzedek Synagogue, that's spelled T-Z-D-E-C, all funds of which will benefit the Simon Wiesenthal Center for Holocaust Propagation. All tickets are sold out, they report, and these tickets cost up to $3,600 each. This is a high rollers crowd. We really need some Canadians from Toronto to commit to going to this synagogue at 1700 North Bathurst Street and standing across the street, if necessary, with signs proclaiming Elie Wiesel to be an imposter who stole another man's identity. Go to my website, go to the CODA forum, go to the CODA revisionist blog, or to NaziGassings.com to read about Wiesel's lack of a number and a tattoo. Contact me if you live in the Toronto area. I would really like to hear from you. This is a big event, and it will garner a lot of publicity. Now, something that's new is the Elie Wiesel Tattoo Contest. Well, it just started, but it's growing. A substantial reward is being offered for a picture of Elie Wiesel's tattoo by some of the posters on the CODA forum. You can find the link to the thread at my website. I guess our St. George from Chapman University saw it there, because he wrote to me last night that he's going back to Chapman in a week or so and let the students know they can win big money by getting Elie to reveal his tattoo. Students always need money, right? Our hero is going to offer $1,000 of his own, and he's blown up Eric Hunt's Where's Wiesel's Tattoo photo collage into a huge poster, he says. So, good for him. That photo collage can be found at CODA. On the thread that says something about Where's Wiesel's Tattoo. He says he plans to get more attention this time than he got last time. Yeah, he's learning. We should all be such willing learners and doers. This is very gratifying to me, and I predict this contest will become a national phenomenon. 2 weeks ago, on May 4th, I interviewed Jim Rizzoli, who is doing such great work with his brother in Massachusetts. His latest public access TV program, during which he talks about and shows pictures of antagonists, or of someone who's become his antagonist, Ron Carr, is really worth watching. You can see it by going to his website, which is www.weeklyshow.blip.tv, and consider sponsoring the Rizzoli's Weekly Show on your own cable local access TV station. Lastly, before I get to my topic, I'm sending out a personal greeting to Steve from Chicago, who I've been wanting to get in touch with for a long time, but have not been successful. Steve is a regular caller to the Michael Collins Piper Report. So, Steve, if this reaches you, please send me an email so I can write to you. All right. Wall Street, international banking, and Adolf Hitler. I imagine some of you listening believe the kind of nonsense about Adolf Hitler that is much too prevalent on the internet and in so many popular and pseudo-scholarly books that are written and consumed. The biggest lie among so many that are commonly circulated that is spread about Adolf Hitler is that he was a tool of the Illuminati or the Zionists or the international bankers. Take your pick. One of the best known of the books that are used to support this allegation is Anthony Sutton's Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. Another is Trading with the Enemy, the Nazi American Money Plot, 1933-1949, by Charles Higham, and many others that go even further downhill in credibility to forgeries like, and I said forgeries, like Hitler's Secret Backers, purportedly written by Sidney Warburg of the Warburg banking family, that came out just after Mr. Warburg died, conveniently. This book is also known on the internet as Hitler's Secret Bankers by Sidney Warburg. I find that very funny when I saw that, but I haven't spent any time trying to figure it out. I have better things to do. Of the internet personalities that cater to this perspective, we can name Alex Jones, the Patriot, Jim Condit, the Catholic, Christopher John Bjerknes, the proud half-Jew, and, of course, Henry Mackow at henrymackow.com. You may already be asking yourself, why do I care? I, meaning me, Carolyn. You may be one who thinks caring about the reputation of Adolf Hitler is suspect, or makes me suspect. Well, I care because I have studied the subject of Hitler, and I hate the constant slander about the man and the way small people make a target out of those who are so very much their superior, and they do it only because they know that Hitler sells, as it said. I got that in quotes. Hitler sells, yes. And it's an easy target, or he's an easy target, one they won't be demanded to show careful evidence for. Like what Henry Mackow does, because I don't believe Henry really believes in all the stuff he publishes on his site. Therefore, in his case, I have to wonder whether his Jewishness has anything to do with it. Henry is a big conspiracy theorist who became a Christian. That is, he is a Christian convert, but who still seems to remain a Jew. Okay, whatever, that's my opinion, and I'm not going to get into that. But just compare Henry's mixed bag, and also Bjerknes, to Brother Nathaniel Kapner, who was a Jew, and is now a Christian with no remaining attachment to his Jewishness whatsoever. In fact, he fights against the power of Judaism in the world, not just Zionism. His website used to be called Real Jew News, but the Jews forced him to change it to Real Zion News. You never hear Brother Kapner beating the drum against Adolf Hitler, as friends of the Jews do. But Henry, who loves conspiracies of every stripe, never saw an anti-Hitler book or article he didn't like. What bothers me the most about Henry is that he picks out a quote here, a fact there, mixes in a little rumor or anecdote, and then concludes something major from those elements when they don't actually add up to his conclusion. It's a false conclusion. It's like a magician's act. But people fall for it. Henry, naturally, is not the only one who does this. Real conspiracies are not that hard to spot. They're obvious once you're no longer blinded by consensus thinking. Remember, consensus thinking is the blindfold that keeps people oblivious to the truth. What is a consensus thinking about Hitler? Well, that he's a bad, bad guy, anti-democratic, a big dictator and all that. What is the consensus thinking about international banking and Wall Street? That it's full of bad, bad guys, anti-democratic big shots and rich cats who get to do whatever they want and break the law. And also that they're Jews. So if you connect Hitler with that, you're not upsetting consensus thinking at all. And yet you can pretend to be into something really bold and far out for the conspiracy lovers. Don't get me wrong. I'm not against conspiracy theories. I just want them to be well constructed, to make sense. Here's a 2007 article by Mackow posted on the widely read Rents.com site and also on his home site. It's titled, Illuminati Bankers Hired Hitler to Start World War II. Let me repeat that title. It really is illuminating. Illuminati Bankers Hired Hitler to Start World War II. I quote, for newcomers, the Illuminati consists, now this is Henry's writing, for newcomers, the Illuminati consists of selected members of dynastic Jewish central banking families intermarried with Euro-American aristocracy, as well as Jesuits who have reached the highest degrees of Kabbalistic Freemasonry. End of quote. For Henry, something called the Illuminati is the club where all the bad guys in the world belong, And it includes a little bit of everybody. Jewish bankers, Catholics, Euro-Americans, aristocrats, and Freemasons, all rolled up into one. They are Satanists, according to him, signifying anti-Christian. And Adolf Hitler was a weak, soulless puppet of these evil conspirators. Yes, like George Bush, Hitler is to be seen as both evil and dangerous, but also weak and ridiculous. Another passage from this article, Henry boldly states, I quote, "I suspect General Kurt von Schleicher was the point man for Illuminati bankers like Max Warburg, whose Frankfurt IG Farben headquarters was spared by Allied bombers." I have to laugh at that. "And whose Jewish mother lived in comfort in Hamburg during the war," unquote. Okay, in this one sentence, we find enough errors to choke a horse. First, he suspects, I put that in quotes too, he suspects, he doesn't know, but he suspects Schleicher, who was a Nazi party member, was a point man for bankers like Max Warburg, without giving a shred of evidence for this in the article. He says, Max, that's the last he says of it, that he suspects. He says that Max Warburg's business was the IG Farben headquarters in Frankfurt, when Max Warburg headed the Warburg Bank in Hamburg and had nothing to do with IG Farben, except he may have done financial lending since he was a banker. Finally, it was Warburg's niece who lived in Hamburg during the war, not his mother, who died in the 20s. So, three strikes and you're out. Henry Mackow strikes out. I used to write to Henry about all the mistakes and craziness in his Hitler articles, and you wouldn't believe the kind of answers I got. He doesn't care. I wrote to him because I thought he had a pretty good website, and I read it at that time. That was before I was as experienced in all this as I am now. Now, thank God, I can talk about it on my own radio show. So this is one example of all the errors that he makes, his errors of fact and scholarship, notwithstanding his PhD title, are the rule, not the exception. I want to use the rest of my time to tell you how it really was. The two evil bankers that are mentioned most often as running Hitler are the already mentioned Max Warburg and Hallmar Schacht. I'm not sure I pronounced that first name right, but it looks something like that, Hallmar Schacht. Both agents for the head honcho, the Rothschild banking dynasty. To give you some background on Max Warburg, he ran his family's international banking business headquartered in Hamburg, Germany. His brother Paul Warburg moved to the U.S. and is the one who was instrumental in creating the United States Federal Reserve, which passed Congress in 1913. These are important Jewish bankers for sure. In Hamburg, at that same time that Paul was birthing the Federal Reserve, Max helped finance construction of Germany's new merchant fleet through the Hapag Company. Hapag, or H-A-P-A-G in all capital letters, was headed by another German Jew, Albert Ballin. This was prior to World War I, remember, and Britain was, we always need to bring Britain into it because Britain plays a big role in all of these wars. Britain was already regarding Germany's fledgling fleet as a grave threat to its naval hegemony. The Warburgs knew this, but Max Warburg's interest as a German banker was in building up German industry and Germany's international trade. At this time, Hitler was a 24-year-old nobody who was still hoping for an architectural career. Though he took a sharp interest in the politics of Germany and was a prolific reader, he had no thought to enter politics. There's no evidence that he did. But he volunteered when the war broke out, as so many German men did, and focused on his soldierly duties with diligence, modesty, and bravery, winning the Iron Cross, and many comments about his praiseworthy behavior as a soldier. It wasn't until the shocking, for him, surrender in 1918 and the devastating realization in 1919 of the betrayal of Germany by not only the Allies but the Social Democrats and the Jews, that he decided to become a political organizer. During the 20 years of the interwar era, then, three quarters of German Jewry became middle class or richer. Let me repeat that. During the 20 years of the interwar era, three-quarters of German Jewry became middle class or richer. We know that the Germans went in the other direction. There were no legal barriers to the Jewish advancement in any field, and Jews were rapidly assimilating through intermarriage. Assimilating is a questionable word. There are those who believe, including the Jewish scholar Jacob Katz, who derives this thesis from a vast body of scholarly literature, that the Jews were not fully integrated into German society, but existed, quote, as a separate subgroup which happened to conform to the German middle class in certain of its characteristics, unquote. This sounds like what we have in America today. To go on, in the year just before Hitler came to power, 1932, more than half the Jews who married took non-Jewish spouses. That is an astounding number, and is according to Ron Chernow's mainstream biography of the Warburgs. These Jews were financially able to prey on the impoverished, starved German people of the Weimar Republic. This is the reason many Germans, not all surely, not all, but many Germans whose families were destitute, allowed themselves to marry the prospering Jews. In this climate, Max Warburg, who was enjoying great success, along with many Germans, was not a Zionist. These wanted to remain where they were, even after the National Socialist Party won the power. Max Warburg opposed the international Jewish boycott of German goods of 1933, not least because his bank derived most of its income from international trade. What I'm trying to explain here is that business is business for businessmen. At that time, in 1933, Max Warburg was a member of the General Council of Germany's Central Bank. In March, he approved, along with the two other Jews on the council, Mendelssohn and Wassermann, Hitler's decision to name Dr. Hallmar Schacht as president of the Reichsbank. His firm also played an important role in facilitating the Havara, or transfer agreement, serving as a conduit for three-fourths of Havara funds, which enriched Max Warburg's bank considerably. For Max Warburg at that time, the continuing success of Germany, or the Third Reich or not, was in his interest. So now let's move on to Schacht. Why did Hitler choose Hallmar Schacht to head the Reichsbank? Hitler knew that he had to get Germany back on its feet again as a leading nation among the community of nations to restore the respect that, as a German patriot, he felt Germany should have. To do this, he needed the confidence of those who held the key to the funding he needed. He also wanted to break down the sharp class divisions which enabled the large landowner and industrialist to feel nothing in common with their laborers and workers. This was the heart of the National Socialist program. Hitler did not want a society of industry versus labor, which breeds class conflict in Marxism-Communism, but a caring society based on German national unity. This is where Hitler's national socialism is in direct contradiction to international trade and banking. As we can so clearly see where we are headed today, to a global elite running a slave constituency of poorly educated third world level workers and lots of police to keep them in line. Schacht was an experienced, respected, accepted member of the international banking community who believed in private banking, but he had something of the German patriot in him, too. And it was Schacht who had helped to bring the outrageous hyperinflation in Germany in 1923 and 1924 under control by strict government regulation. So he had already been in government and was familiar with working in government. What happened is this. After the war and the punishing conditions of the Versailles Treaty, the German Reichsmark was weak and therefore became the victim of speculation by foreign investors who were selling it short. The way to ruin a currency is well known to be widespread short selling. Short selling is basically gambling that the price of an asset will drop. At first, the speculation was fed by the recently privatized, and I repeat, recently privatized, German Central Bank, which means it was printing marks to accommodate the demand of the borrowers who were expecting to pay back their loan with cheaper marks. When the Reichsbank could no longer keep up with the voracious demand, other private banks, that is, foreign banks, were allowed to create marks out of nothing and lend them at interest as well. This is what private banks can do, which a national bank could never do. As a matter of fact, it was the Allies who insisted the Reichsbank be made more independent of the government. And on March 26, 1922, right before the advent of that uniquely horrible hyperinflation, the law that ended up disallowing the Chancellor any influence whatsoever over the conduct of the bank was put forth. So look no farther for the culprits. They are it. I want you to understand me here. The German people were so weak, so undefended, so hatefully and spitefully used that the privatized German Central Bank allowed other national central banks to print German marks for nothing and lend them at interest for themselves, which could only further destroy the Reichsmark. Of course, that's what it did. By November 1923, the mark was worth only 1/1,000,000,000,000 of what it had been worth back in 1914. We're talking about 9 years' time here. Since 1913, the U.S. dollar has lost 1/100,000,000,000 of its purchasing power. Think of what 1/1,000,000,000,000 would be, or 1,000,000,000,000, however that works. How does this synchronize with the talk today of Weimar-style hyperinflation for the U.S. and Britain? Britain today is funding more of its government budget by seigniorage, or printing fiat money, than Germany was in 1924. And the U.S. is not far behind Germany at that time. This alone, obviously, does not bring on hyperinflation. It was the speculation and short selling by foreign investors that did it, something which is not happening to Britain in the U.S. today. Why would it? They are the financial controllers of the world, which struggling Weimar Germany was not. It was their victim. Hallmar Schacht revealed all this in a book he wrote in 1967 called The Magic of Money. 44 years after the fact, he let the world in on this secret. As president of the Reichsbank, he, working with the Weimar government, got the situation under control by the elimination of foreign speculation. This was accomplished by eliminating easy access to loans. Everybody should know that easy money is the darling of private banking. At the beginning of 1924, Schacht had become president of the Reichsbank. Now, this was right during the hyperinflation. He pursued a brutal contraction of money supply, and by the end of the year, Germany was making headway against inflation. Schacht had a fondness for strong money. That was part of his banking mentality. He wasn't just a cookie-cutter central banker, and of course he wasn't Jewish. Schacht remained head of the Reichsbank until 1930. At that time, he resigned in a dispute over some of the Allies' rulings. The Allies, it seems, were still running things. He was reappointed by Hitler in 1933 in a move to reassure German big business and foreign bankers. It was German businessmen, among them Thyssen and Krupp, who petitioned President Hindenburg to appoint Hitler as chancellor. This was after the Nazis won the plurality in the Reichstag in the 32 election. Yes, you heard that right. You know, it was the German businessmen who were petitioning Hindenburg to appoint Hitler. They, along with politicians Hugenberg and von Papen, thought that they could control and direct Hitler while at the same time taking advantage of his strengths and popularity to bring much-needed order and confidence to the populace. Schacht raised money from banking and business interests for Hitler's 1932 election campaign. And even earlier than that, German business was contributing to his party coffers. All this is known, and there is nothing sinister about it. As Reichsbank president and later as finance minister, Schacht continued to open the money channels of international financing for the Third Reich. He supported public works programs, most notably the construction of the Autobahn, and to attempt to alleviate unemployment. Okay, I'm going to end my little talk now and pick it up after the break. I'll be with you in a couple of minutes. Hang on.
right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Europe's Human Rights Court has upheld the conviction of a Soviet veteran accused of war crimes in Latvia during the Second World War. It reverses the court's previous decision 2 years ago that Vasily Kononov could not be a war criminal because he was a freedom fighter. Tom Barton is in Riga with the details.
It's been a long trial. It's been 12 years in total. And this decision by the European Court of Human Rights today overturns a previous decision made in 2008. That decision was that the Latvian judges didn't have a basis in international law to send Vasily Kononov to prison for 2 years, which they'd already done. So it was in retrospect. The Latvian government then appealed, which led to this decision today, which has said that actually they did have that basis, and that they were right to send him to prison. The incident goes back to all the way to 1944. Kononov's group of Soviet partisans came to the village in Latvia because they suspected that the Nazis had been tipped off by Nazi collaborators. They held a tribunal, after which they executed 9 of the villagers. And the dispute ever since has been whether those people were unarmed civilians or armed Nazi collaborators. And Kononov thinks they were. The Latvian government thinks that they weren't. This decision, a great blow for Kononov himself. However, he says he's defiant and he's going to continue on fighting.
Latvia has successfully fooled the European court. Long ago, it got rid of the main evidence from my case that the people were executed were fighting, volunteers, armed combatants. Latvia claims they were farmers. That's a lie. Under German occupation, they weren't farming. They were spending whole night on patrol and were sleeping over the day. We have a right to appeal this decision. We're preparing it as fast as possible. And our position is gaining a lot of support from many European countries. And I'm sure the decision will be made soon and in our favor.
Really crosses some deep rift lines in Latvian society. For more on the background of this in detail, I prepared a report earlier, and we can watch that now.
This man may not look like a warrior, but he's certainly been through the wars. 87-year-old Vasily Kononov fought against the Nazis in his native Latvia as a Soviet resistance fighter. His parents and aunt were sent to concentration camps in Germany. His uncle and cousins were killed in combat. Vasily himself was wounded many times, suffered shell shock twice, and needed 3 operations for his injuries after the war.
In my partisan squad, I was an explosives expert. I was responsible for blowing up 42 military targets, including 16 supply trains. I saved the lives of many people in Latvia.
So it might seem surprising that his government, far from being grateful, treats him as a war criminal. Since 1998, he's been tried 6 times and put in prison for 2 years. In February 1944, Nazi troops surrounded and burnt down a barn in Latvia, killing 12 partisans sheltering inside, including 2 women and a baby. Kononov says the Nazis were tipped off by collaborating locals and police.
They persuaded the partisans to stay for the night, but the police chief sent his deputy to the Germans when the partisans went to sleep. German soldiers encircled the barn, there was a fight, and then the Nazis set it on fire.
After a tribunal, his partisans tried and executed 9 villagers, but Latvian prosecutors say they were unarmed civilians.
We have only testimony that Germans provided local people with arms for their self-defense, but there are no documents in the Kononov case that prove that they served in the police or any other paramilitary unit.
Kononov argues they were armed.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I was talking about Hitler's relationship with his finance minister, Hjalmar Schacht, and why he chose Schacht. And we're going to talk now about who was a Rothschild agent or who wasn't, and what difference does it make, okay? So was Hjalmar Schacht a Rothschild agent? Well, perhaps so, but perhaps he was too stubbornly independent and too much of a brilliant individualist to be anybody's agent. That's what I tend to think. But even if he was a Rothschild man, does that mean that Hitler was too? Of course not. Just as Alfred Hugenberg and Franz von Papen, who were both political allies and competitors of Hitler, thought they could control Hitler if he was made chancellor, they were wrong, and it was they who were put out to pasture eventually, or fairly soon. Likewise, when Hjalmar Schacht's privatization and free market ideas came into conflict with Hitler and Goering's plans in 1937, he was forced out as economics minister, remaining president of the Reichsbank until Hitler dismissed him in January 1939. Max Warburg was also forced out when the time came. Schacht had no further influence in the government after that and became loosely connected with the so-called German resistance from then on. When Hitler put Dr. Walter Funk in charge of the Reichsbank, he directed him to make the Reichsbank, now I quote, a German bank of issue unconditionally subjected to the sovereignty of the state in conformity with National Socialist principles. And this is according to a Time magazine article from 1939. Hitler still believed that the state should create and control its money supply through a nationalized central bank, quote, again, breaking down the thraldom of interest, unquote, as he had written in Mein Kampf back in 1924. In Billions for the Bankers, Debts for the People, which was written by Sheldon Emery and published in 1984, Mr. Emery writes, and I quote again, Germany issued debt-free and interest-free money from 1935 and on, accounting for its startling rise from the Depression to a world power in 5 years. Germany financed its entire government and war operation from 1935 to 1945 without gold and without debt, and it took the whole capitalist and communist world to destroy the German power over Europe and bring Europe back under the heel of the bankers. It's clear that Hitler's example was an existential threat to the global world money order, so both he and Germany had to be not only destroyed, but demonized in such a way that nothing like it could or would ever rise again. Those who throw Hitler and National Socialism into their own global New World Order Illuminati international banker mix are assisting the very ones they believe they are fighting. One reason they do it, if they are indeed not disinformation agents themselves, is because they want a world order based on religion, their own religion, of course. Well, I said one reason. I think that is one reason. And they believe Adolf Hitler was a pagan who was against religion. Hitler was actually a friend to Christianity. He built churches. He didn't tear them down. But he didn't want the church to run the state, and neither do I. Economist Henry Liu has written, through an, in I quote, through an independent monetary policy of sovereign credit and a full employment public works program, the Third Reich was able to turn a bankrupt Germany, stripped of overseas colonies, into the strongest economy in Europe within 4 years, even before armament spending began. Germany even managed to restore foreign trade despite the international bankers' denial of foreign credit to Germany and despite the global boycott by Jewish-owned industries. Germany succeeded in this by exchanging equipment and commodities directly with other countries using a barter system that cut the bankers out of the picture. Germany flourished since barter eliminates national debt and trade deficits. Now, how does cutting the bankers out of the picture jive with Hitler being a puppet of the bankers? That is never discussed on Henry Mackow's site. Another of Hitler's powerful statements is this, quote, the nation does not live for the sake of the economic system, and the economic system does not exist for the sake of capital. On the contrary, capital is the servant of the economic system, and the economic system is the servant of the people. unquote. Schacht explained this in his banker's language as it was necessary to discover a method that would avoid inflating the investment holdings of the Reichsbank. And that's the end of that quote, too. In other words, these are my words, we needed a way to grow the economy without inflating the money supply. Another explanation that comes from a source in the spirit world is, what you call your economy is the exchange of human energy. So there you have it, folks. It's all very simple. But now, to get back to and complete our story, what happened to Hugenberg and von Papen and to Schacht likewise happened to Max Warburg. Until 1938, he benefited from his cordial personal relationship with Dr. Schacht and his cooperation with the Hitler regime. But as Schacht's influence with Hitler waned, so did Warburg's position in German business. As German corporations were slowly Aryanized, and they were, Warburg was forced to substitute a trusted non-Jewish company employee for himself on the 100 or so corporate boards on which he held a seat. The Warburg Bank itself was Aryanized in May 1938. It was turned over to a non-Jewish employee, Rudolf Brinkmann, and Max Warburg left his Hamburg office for the last time. A short while later, he left Germany forever, dying in 1946 in the United States. The firm's traditional name was changed in 1941 to Brinkmann, Wirtz and Company. So, as you can see, Max Warburg lost out in the end to Hitler, too. But, of course, they operated from their base in the United States, and once the evil empires had defeated Hitler, they were back in business in the new denazified Germany once again. The two Warburg family members who remained in Germany throughout the Third Reich era, well, much is sometimes made that they did so, but there is nothing to be made of it, really. They were Marietta Warburg, Max's niece, whom the careless Henry Macau misidentified as his mother, who lived unmolested and in relative comfort in a suburb of Hamburg with her non-Jewish and anti-Nazi husband. In Hamburg alone, 600 Jews survived the war years, including the devastating firebombing. Many of them were married to non-Jews. You should be aware that it was a National Socialist Third Reich policy not to break up families. This is something else that is constantly lied about. So many of these Jews that remained and survived in Germany were married to non-Jews. And an even more distant relative, but not all. I don't even know that the majority were that way. But an even more distant relative, a scientist, Otto Warburg, was permitted by special order from the Reich Chancellery, that's Hitler, to continue his work on cancer research at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin, because he said that he needed to remain there, he could not transfer his work elsewhere, and so he was allowed to do so. Today, bringing us up to today, instead of Adolf Hitler's vision of a united Europe, which did not include Britain or Russia, for good reason at that time, a loosely united Europe, but united under the umbrella of a more tightly united Germanic League, standing firm against the communist ideology, we have, instead of that, the European Union of supposedly equal members, of course, meaning we must accede to egalitarianism, under the tight supervision of the international or central banking establishment. This union is economic and financial in nature, not cultural, historical, or based on shared values. The European states are forced more and more into a single lockstep and are expected to welcome those of all races and nationalities, including especially Jews from everywhere. Yet it may be that this trend toward globalization is reaching difficulties that it has no way or means to overcome. The supposedly coming global currency that so many expect may turn out to be as much fantasy as one world government turns out to be. James Kunstler, who is a sometimes financial writer, suspects that events are taking the nations of the world in the other direction towards breakup, downsizing, downscaling. I can see a great deal of evidence for that myself, and I'm sure you also can. Likewise, if major currencies such as the euro and the dollar blow up, they're much more likely to be replaced by more local banknotes backed by gold than by an Amero or something called the Global Buck. We may be studying Adolf Hitler's economic structure and patterning ourselves on that. Kunstler says the stock market has become a, now this is, I'm quoting from Kunstler, the robot combat arena where algorithms battle for supremacy of the feedback loops, and people too clever by half, aided greatly by computers, have now gamed the investment indexes so successfully that these markets no longer have anything to do with investment. They're just about shaving micro points of profit at high volumes by micro milliseconds off mere differentials in math. And also, we may be on the verge of a spontaneous capital combustion in which the putative contents of these stock markets get sucked into a black hole so vast that the trading desks will have to find a way to arbitrage infinity to ever again catch a glimpse of America's receding wealth. And it could all happen in a finger snap. Well, we have seen evidence of that lately, and it's all become too big and too sophisticated for anyone to control. And who knows how it can all just fall into pieces. Then there is the Greek question I'd like to speak about a little bit. Another financial writer, Stuart Doherty, comments that the Greek protests demonstrate that there is little understanding among the people about the end game nature of their nations and the West's fiscal, financial, and economic crisis. The end game nature. Having been given, he says, a world-class education in stupidity when it comes to government budgeting and spending, national deficits, sovereign debt, citizen entitlements, government salaries, public welfare programs, government employee and military pensions, socialized health care, and virtually all other fiscal matters of state, the people are living in a state of sheer cluelessness and delusion. The Greek people accepted all the upgrading of their standard of living without having to do any upgraded work for it. Well, that last is my comment. Doherty says the citizens have been awarded doctorates in ignorance on the subject of how the money elite, epitomized by Goldman Sachs, has over the past 20 years plundered the West and sucked its national economies dry. Apparently, the Greeks believe that protests, Molotov cocktails, and rage can bring back to life the parched economic wasteland they now inhabit. But that earth has been so mercilessly scorched by the uncontained and sociopathic predations of politicians and their money power blood brothers that it will be years before true rehabilitation can be achieved, if they are fortunate. The problem today is that money, even big money, does not know where to go. No place is safe. If big money is concerned about the euro, then it must be similarly concerned about the dollar. Where it is now fleeing? Where does it go from the dollar? The moral of this story is, those who believe in make-believe and fairy tales will eventually have a rude awakening. So let's do a better job of recognizing the fairy tales. One way is that they never quite make sense. They are of a nature that we must suspend our critical thinking and just believe. Yes, I know that feels good, but in the end, we always have to wake up. An interesting story I saved for the last, if I had time for it, is about a poll taken in Russia about the attitudes of the people toward what is known as Katyn. This poll was taken by the Levada Center in Moscow, a kind of a think tank. The article was written by Alexei Levinson. I won't question about him. He's a sociologist and senior researcher at the center. He says that he found the results rather startling, and so he has commented rather extensively on them. Now, I found this rather startling, too. Maybe not so startling, but certainly very interesting. The poll was conducted the week after the April 10th plane crash that killed over 90 high-level Polish dignitaries while trying to land for the Katyn commemoration ceremonies in Smolensk, Russia. I had Dr. Wilhelm Christman on, and we talked about that quite a bit at that time. You know, there were a lot of conspiracy theories going around about what caused the plane crash, but it's pretty well settled down. Keeping that in mind, the responses to the questions were surprising. I spoke earlier about the dumbing down and the educational diplomas in stupidity that I was talking about as far as the United States goes, but they are not restricted to the U.S. or to the West. Now, the Russians, first they were asked what they considered the main problems underlying Russo-Polish relations. And only a minority of Russians saw it as Russia's problem. The majority laid the blame for the problems on Poland. The author explains to us a little bit. He says, in Russia today, social surveys often acquire a function more serious than simply representing current points of view. In the absence of public politics and any tradition of public debate, and he points out that the internet is available only to a small percentage of the population. I had not thought about that. I guess it might be that they won't have any service in a lot of areas, or maybe even in Moscow. Not that many people have internet service. In any case, these surveys give people who want to express themselves the opportunity to do so and to take up position. They don't have the kind of debate going on all the time on the internet the way we do in the West, according to him. In this first question, where should we lay the blame on the current problems between Russia and Poland? And 25% blamed the recent U.S. plans to deploy the ABM system in Poland. 22% said it was Poland's desire to move away from Russia toward Europe. And 18% pointed out the lack of gratitude on the Polish side for being liberated from fascism and for the economic support in the years after the war. Now, all of those folks, now that is 50, 60, 70, close to 80% maybe were blaming Poland for the problems. And this last one, the lack of gratitude on the side of the Poles, boy, where have they been? And, you know, what have they been taught? Later on, the interview moved on to Katyn. And again, the author of this article comments, the subject of the death of people and even of the guilt for it was replaced by something completely different, the recognition or non-recognition of this guilt. So it's not whether they're guilty, but should we recognize it or not? The most difficult moral question could have been addressed, that of collective responsibility and the guilt of nations for the actions of their leaders and the people that carried out the orders. Remember that being put on the Germans? But it wasn't. This was not the question addressed. The question was another one, whether to accept the blame or lay it on someone else. And here he says, in this case, the Germans. Or to accept it secretly and deny it in public, or the other way around, to accept it in public and deny it secretly. So according to this poll, approximately 25% of adult Russians have never heard of Katyn and have no opinion on it. 25%. After all that had happened, this was a week after the plane crash. But almost twice as many, 47%, have no opinion on what is now the main question. Who were the killers at Katyn? Remember this, again, this was 1 week after the plane crash. So 47 have no opinion on who were the killers. What's going on in the news there? What are people being told? Okay, breaking it down in the under 25 age bracket, under 25 now, under 25-year-olds, 56% were unable to make up their minds. 56% didn't know a thing. In this group, 37% had never heard of Katyn, and 19% found out about it after 2000. And of that 19% who found out about it after 2000, 15% found out when Putin went to Katyn. That was just, you know, in the last few weeks before this. And 19% found out after the plane crash a week ago. So that's some 30% of those under 25 who just learned about it in the last weeks. The way they learned about it, it should have made them unable to believe the Stalinist lie, because, you know, they learned about it because of the commemorations and so on. Yet, they still clung to it. They still clung to the lie. As a result, among the young people who have an opinion, that is not those 56% who didn't have an opinion, among the rest of them who had an opinion about who organized the executions in the Katyn Forest, 21% named the Stalinist leadership of the USSR as the killers, but slightly more, 23%, named Hitler's government in Germany. Now, two-thirds of young people have no idea that there is documentary evidence that the Polish officers were shot by the NKVD. But among the others, those who do, 13% answered that they knew and had no doubts on the subject, whereas 22% said that they knew but they had doubts. The distribution in all other age groups was different. We're talking about the older people now. Slightly less than half were don't knows. More than half hadn't had an opinion. The rest were divided, with 2-1, twice as many believing that the killing had been on Stalin's orders. Those are the ones who had an opinion. In the age group 25 and above, the proportions were roughly the same. The majority consider that there can be doubt of NKVD involvement. You know, no matter how much the rest of the world understands this, and we believe that the Russians understand it, that they must be very as clear as we are on it, they are not clear on it at all. They're back in some time warp. All right, among those surveyed, only 24% knew that in 1990 the Soviet leadership had accepted responsibility for the Soviet government's part in the executions. There we go. Of all the respondents, only 24%, one quarter of them, knew that the Soviet leadership had accepted this responsibility. 76% of Russians said this was the first they'd heard of it. You could put this lack of knowledge down to the fact that it was a long time ago and big political changes have occurred, etc. But what is the explanation for the 65% and of the young people's 83% who said they didn't know that the last time Putin went to Poland, he accepted responsibility for our part in the Katyn tragedy? Now, the author says, Putin is obviously not the kind of person whose words are not listened to or are refuted. And it should not be forgotten that, on the whole, Putin's actions as head of the Russian government were endorsed in this survey by 78%. And among young people, 83% endorsed Putin as head of the government. They are quite happy with him. That's not at all surprising to us. For the success of his foreign policy, he was obviously going to have to acknowledge Russia's guilt in the Katyn affair. Now, this is the author saying, giving his views, that for foreign policy, he has to, and he has had to, and he's known it, and he's done it, acknowledged Russia's guilt. But this would be completely at odds with his domestic policies. For his foreign policy to succeed, he had to break with his image and surprise the world. But for his domestic policy, he had to stick to his guns. I tell you, I have to admit, I'm a little envious that the Germans can't have people like Putin on their side, but the German government goes along with Putin. This is something very sick here. I don't know who's the sickest, the Russians or the Germans. The survey shows that he was successful in solving the problem. Perhaps the virtuosity of the Russian mass media had something to do with it, that the words and gestures of their prime minister were relayed in such a way that his confessions didn't reach two-thirds of his Russian audience. But that's probably not it, because he has excellent relations with a significant part of his society, and they understand something, that when something is not destined for them, they just don't hear it. And so for the world, Putin called the executions at Katyn a crime which cannot be justified. But for the Russian audience, he let slip that Stalin was avenging the 30,000 Red Army soldiers who had been taken prisoner by the Poles during the unsuccessful Warsaw Campaign in 1920. It's hard work protecting your own people for decades by denying evil, Levinson concludes. People have good instincts. So he says that on hearing about the death of the Polish president in the plane crash, two-thirds of Russians said they felt sympathy, but one-quarter percent were horrified. Only one-quarter percent were horrified. Two-thirds felt only sympathy. He says, well, we can be sure that they are absolutely sincere. Well, the writer is obviously not impressed with the Russian attitudes, even though he's Russian, and I don't know where his sympathies lie, but it sounds like a leftist, but he certainly does have a point, and I think this is very revealing, too. Well, I leave you with that. ladies and gentlemen, that is the show for tonight. I hope you enjoyed it. Please tune in again. I will be back next week, probably with a guest. Thank you and good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.